Hello, my name is Phil Blancato, and I am CEO and President of Latimer Thalmann Asset Management, a division of Advisor Group. Believe it or not, we are halfway through the year. It's already July the 1st. Hopefully, wherever you are safe and sound and enjoying the summer weather. Well, as we have talked about so often, the key thing for us to monitor as we understand the economic impact of the virus is what's the latest and greatest with the virus. And whether or not we can continue to accelerate the opening or reopening of the American economy and the global economy. Well, there's no doubt on everybody's mind the recent outbreak of the big four states, which represent 50% of the virus increase, has everyone concerned. California, Florida, Texas, and Arizona are very much on everyone's mind. And what we're watching is how much of this is due to increasing of testing, and how much of this simply is due to the reality of more and more people getting sick. And when you come right down to it, certainly the idea that there is an increase in testing is having an impact on the number of cases in the country. However, there is no denying that in those states there has been a significant spike. And what we've tried to monitor for you this whole way through with not only the projections of the virus, watching what's happened in Europe and how they bent the curve, flattened it, and are now living in a, to a degree, a post-COVID world. In New York City, we're in a very much a post-COVID world from the infection rate, where our daily infections are at all-time lows. The number of people dying are down in the single digits. We have had excellent success in mitigating the impact in New Jersey, New York, Connecticut. The reality is the businesses in New York City are still shuttered. The restaurants still do not allow people in. We're still very, very much in a lockdown state, other than some relief of being able to eat outside on the street or spend some time with loved ones down at the beach. But by and large, we're still very limited to what we can do, attending stores on a limited basis. All that has helped areas like Europe and New York and other states in the country bend and break the virus where we can live with it. But there is areas that are concerned. And when we've looked back, understanding projections and understanding the benefit of more testing, it came down to understanding that positive tests increasing usually means the outbreak is getting worse, except, you know, when we looked at the percent of positive tests, generally they were going down. And by that I mean the infectious rate. What we've seen is the more tests people we tested in the United States, the more the percent of the population had been coming down, which was a wonderful sign. The average infectious rate was between 4 and 6%. What we're seeing in some of these other states is that that's no longer the case. We're not seeing the outbreaks slowing down. We're not seeing that, even though we're ramping up testing, the outbreak or the percentage infective rate is actually going up. We're actually seeing the outbreak getting worse. And in most cases, the speed of the disease is now faster than the testing in those four states. But I don't want to throw the old line, don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because there is something to be said about when you draw the line in the sand around Memorial Day and you start projecting from there out. When you look at the original hotspots, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Washington, they have all considerably come down to where they were at the peak of the virus in April at 15,000 cases a day to today, just all of them collectively less than 1,000. Conversely, when you think about the rest of the country, we continue to come down. With Memorial Day being the peak, the rest of the states are either flattened, but most cases continuing to come down with adding a few thousands of cases a day, but at a much slower rate for the rest of the country. The key is the 50% of those hotspots, which I mentioned earlier, have really accelerated since Memorial Day. And if you think about the folks that whoever were outdoors around the Memorial Day holiday for whatever reason, out participating in some of the protests that took place, or just for whatever reason out there enjoying time in restaurants and bars, what we found is some of those states that were somewhat earlier didn't have the restrictions around face masks and social distancing that some of the other states did. So it has resulted in a spike. We are seeing a significant number of people get sick with the virus. But I think it's important that we spend some time taking a look at what does that mean so far. Well, comparatively in New York City, when we look back at New York, there is still nearly 18,500 people that passed away from the virus. what we know, the vast preponderance, 99% of them, had a pre-existing condition or were over the age of 65. Today, about 80% of Americans who have died from COVID are 65 years and older. And that is a very important factor in this, because when we look at states like Florida, 84% of the deaths in Florida are people who are 65 and older. But of the total cases, especially the new one, 85% of the total cases are between the ages of 20 and 64. So the newest cases, the vast preponderance, are either where anywhere from 50 to 80% are actually below the age of 32. So what we're seeing is that whether it's Florida, the new cases are much younger people. When we look at California, 78% of the deaths occurred in people over the age of 65. And those between the age of 20 and 64 represent 86% of the cases. So we're seeing this narrative in both states, both big states that have had lots of pressure on them about what's happened with the virus. But here's a key negative point. The current positivity rate in Florida is 14.5%, just about a double the national average. California is only about 6%. So California has done an excellent job of sustaining or maintaining their positivity rate. So part of their issue is, yes, there's a spike in California, but part of it is also from testing, versus Florida, where they're absolutely having a spike. But when you think about Florida, their death rate is very interesting in that when you look at their death rate and how that has progressed, it actually has continued to come down. And in fact, the peak of their death rates was on June 2nd of 41 people a day, where now it's trending down on a pretty consistent basis, generally most days, not all, but most days below 30. So we're seeing that narrative play out time and time again, where Florida has increased the number of tests, for example, on June 29th from 43,000 to all the way up to 78,000 on June 29th, 43,000, on June 26th, 78,000. Earlier in the pandemic, only a few thousand. So significantly increasing their testing rate, which bears to why they're seeing an increase in cases, but also their infectious rate, for every one person infecting multiple people after that. Whereas with California, we haven't quite seen that yet. But one of the key ingredients here is how much of an impact is this having on hospitalizations. So much of it is, since it's with a younger population, those who are not getting terribly sick. What we have seen is in places like Florida, as of now, the increase in hospitalizations so far is something to be concerned about, but not significant enough to really get very concerned of as of yet. So certainly bears watching, but we're not quite there yet from an overall concern of how bad is it affecting the overall hospitalization rate. Definitely an increase, but there's still plenty of beds available, plenty of ICU beds available in both places. For example, in California, there were 3,730 ICU beds available. At the end of May, there were 3,860 beds available. So we've only seen a very modest drop in California. For example, there are 4.1 million people have been tested out of 39 million people who live in the state, almost 11% of the population, one of the highest testing rates in the country. So it's imperative that we look at the data from both sides. Another example, Arizona. Roughly 79,000 cases in Arizona. Actually, since June 22nd, the number of new cases is trending down, so there's a potential that it's getting better. But out of the ICU beds, of the roughly 1,500 ICU beds in Arizona, roughly 680 are folks who have COVID. If we went back to the just a month earlier, that number represented about 380 people that were in the ICU from COVID. So of all the people that have been infected in Arizona, and it is true they've had a pretty significant increase, only about 300 additional people are in the ICU. And yes, there is pressure on their ICU. Yes, they are more than 80% occupied, but they were 63% occupied before the pandemic began. So Arizona traditionally had a much higher rate of ICU occupancy, perhaps as an older population. But same data, thinking it through, 74% of the deaths in Arizona occurred in individuals over the age of 65. However, of the total cases, 88% were people between the age of 20 to 64. So certainly, we have to be careful when we look at the data. As of now, we're not putting extensive pressure on the Texas the Arizona, the Flora, California hospital system. Texas is one that has been in the news a lot. We've been so much concerned about their significant spike, where they had their highest day so far, 7,000 new cases on June the 30th, thereabouts. But their daily fatalities peaked in May at 58, with the latest data being 21 deaths. 72% of deaths in Texas occurred in individuals over the age of 65. Yet, when we look at the total number of infections, believe it or not, to be even more myopic here, between 18 and 40 make up 52% of all new cases and 88% of all cases up to 65. So what we're finding is the same narrative continues to play out. But in Texas, there's currently 6,533 people in the hospital due to COVID. That number was 4,092 last week, so almost a 1,500 person, 1,400 and change per increase. That's a big number. There are 13,711 available hospital beds. Last week, there were 14,260, so 500 bed decrease. There are 1,405 ICU beds. Last week, it was 1,483. Something doesn't add up there. We've only increased the number of ICU beds by about 78, yet we've added thousands of new people. The reason why is for many of the new people that are getting sick, they are recovering without having to go to the ICU, and that's because of their age. So far, the issue is actually less about the new cases. It's much more about understanding who is going getting sick, what the impact of them getting sick, and what it could do to not only our social fabric, but our economic fabric as well. Let's remember something we've talked in the past about, which is the average age of the American workforce is under the age of 54. It's actually 76% of the workforce is under the age of 54. Those folks are less susceptible to fatalities or getting very sick. So there is a path to managing this spike, which is making sure we have enough capacity in our hospitals, protecting those folks who are most vulnerable, protecting folks over the age of 65, which, by the way, being over the age of 65 is not a death sentence. It's still only 10% of the folks 65 and older that passed from COVID, so there are plenty of folks that have recovered. But when you look at the data globally and in the United States, what we're seeing is a separation between the death rate and the new case rate. And that could be for a lot of reasons. That could be because younger people are getting it as they move around more and aren't smart on social distancing. It could be because disease is less potent. There's belief out of Italy and the University of Pittsburgh that the disease is less potent. It could also be that the area that are being impacted as of now haven't been severely impacted up until this point. I mentioned earlier that New York City has had almost 18,500 people pass away. If you combined all four states, actually, if you look at the total number of deaths in Florida, which is 3,505, the total number of deaths in California, which is 5,980, total deaths in Arizona, which is 1,632, and Texas at 2,424, that still does not add up to how many have passed away in New York City alone. So certainly they haven't had the impact that's been had here. And there are major cities in all those states. So maybe not as big and as crowded as New York, but certainly think of a Houston, a Dallas, a Los Angeles, a San Francisco, a San Diego, a Miami, a Fort Lauderdale. There are areas that have real crowding, and to be specific, they haven't had the same impact as we've had here in New York City. So I think it stands to reason that as we analyze the spike, it's not out of the question to go one level deeper and have some level of optimism that the reason we're not seeing the fatality rate is, as of now, we're not seeing the elderly get infected again. We're not seeing the most vulnerable get infected again, as of now. Hopefully that stands true. And now one of the measures that's been put in place of, either shutting down bars, restaurants, and nightclubs, or mandating masks should help. Remember, we talked a bit about this in the past, if you had a chance to listen to earlier talks. The way you get this disease is to be within a room with somebody for greater than 15 minutes that is not wearing a mask, you're not wearing a mask, and they're aerosolizing the virus. It's very rare, if at all, to get it from a surface. It really requires an extended period of time with someone who's putting droplets in the air to create that viral impact. And that is a really significant finding, because what that means is, you think about the environment in a bar, in a nightclub. I happened to go to Texas recently and noticed quite a few people not wearing masks in a bar. Restaurants, crowded places, outdoor places, even with large crowds, could create this. Indoor environments, believe it or not, air conditioning is not our friend in this environment. I know, think about these places are all hot places. When it gets real hot, where do folks go? Indoors. There's a study about how indoor air conditioning is having an impact by spreading the virus inside because folks aren't outside, whether the virus will dry up in the hot air. So that's interesting, that take. Kind of an interesting anecdotal point, a company like a Honeywell, which is rapidly developing technology that they can install in buildings to be able to use ultraviolet light to kill the virus, is very powerful because even indoors with a HEPA filter and this particular type of ultraviolet light would allow us to eliminate the virus indoors as well, which we're 10 times more susceptible indoors than we are outdoors. So that's a powerful component of this, that if we can mitigate that impact, we should then be able to stem the virus. Dr. Scott Gottlieb is fond of saying, if 60% of the country wore masks 100% of the times when they're in crowded places, bars, restaurants, outdoor settings, we would effectively eliminate the transmission of the virus in a relative short amount of time, about 3 months. So hopefully we begin to learn the lessons of the last few months and begin to get some of this under control. It looks early right now that Arizona is improving, and let's hope that the governors are working together to install some of these requirements to get us there. So I'm not ready to panic about the spike, but it is noteworthy and certainly worthwhile watching. So now let's switch gears. I think it's important to continue on and talk about the latest around economics. Just today, we had a report come out about new jobs. And in fact, remember we saw last month the job picture brightened considerably. We expected roughly around 25 to 30 million people to be on the unemployment line. It turned out that the reopening process had put quite a few people back and employed. And it worked out that we actually ended up at around 20.5 million people unemployed. Still a terrible number, but better than expected. Now, the most recent private payroll report from Automatic Data Processing, or ADP, suggests that the number they initially reported in May was wrong by roughly 5 million people. They reported a negative 2.7 million jobs going away in May, and in fact, when they reanalyzed their data because of some inconsistencies in the data, they realized that actually 5.7 million were added. That is a significant swing, an additional 2.3 million added in the month of June. So now we're looking at potentially 8 million jobs added, where the unemployment number could be as low as 14 million, which is still a terrible number, but a marked improvement. And that is because the whole country is now open for business one way or another. If you look at the data, actually companies with 50 or less employees added the most folks. And especially in places like leisure, hospitality, restaurants, and so on. So the reopening is happening, albeit it's going to be lumpy because in certain places they're having to slow down and be mindful about it because of the spike. But no doubt about it is happening. It's having an effect on economics. That's a really powerful outcome. Now, the federal government, in lockstep with them, is also seriously considering a second round of stimulus. What we saw is actually incomes in the month of April went up. Really because the federal government decided to give everybody capital, which is, you know, an interesting way to think about it. But money actually, per the IRS data, increased. People made money in the month of April. So what we're seeing is because of the federal programs of adding $600 extra per week per person who is unemployed, the original $1,200 stimulus check, the PPP program, which is the protection program for small businesses, now being extended to August 8th, and the forgiveness of debt potentially going out past October, as well as for support from municipalities, has really been a boon for the market. The Federal Reserve has thrown a safety net under the bond market. The federal government's buying bonds of companies that need to make sure their bonds are liquid, and they're also supplying money to municipalities as they need it. Add to that that the consumer, because of the money they received, is actually in pretty good shape. Let's not forget that consumer spending represents 70% of the American economy, or put another way, that's of the $21 trillion economy we have today, roughly $13 trillion of it is from consumer spending. Can you believe the entire Chinese economy is only $14 trillion? So our consumer is almost as big as the entire Chinese economy. and we look at the most recent data, we have seen a pretty significant increase at a month-over-month increase of almost 16% in consumer spending. Heck, a good example, Walmart online sales soared by 74% in the first quarter. Amazon up 25% year-over-year. Home sales got clobbered in the month of April, down 34%, only to rebound by 16.5% for just by the middle of May. The U.S. consumer has actually hung in there quite well, especially because the amount of money we spend on debt today is the lowest since 1980. Add one more, then when we look at the overall consumer picture, they have high savings rate. We have high savings rate. For every dollar we make, we're actually saving about 23 cents. That number was 33 cents. So it is a significant increase in the amount of money that we save. And why I think that's important is because as consumers save more money, it allows them to have pent-up demand, the ability to spend if, in fact, the economy continues to open up. So I do think it bears watching from the idea that there is good data coming, what we call green shoots. And whether it's, as I mentioned, the housing market, we're actually seeing new home sales are beginning to increase as well, a significant increase is there, that we could see as many as 3.9 million homes are potentially going to come for sale or to be built in the next year. So we're seeing a real increase in the housing market. And one of the things that's very positive about the housing market is from the housing standpoint, when your home doesn't lose value, when it continues to hold its value, that is the anchor of your assets. And for many people, when their home is holding their value, it keeps their consumer confidence high. And high confidence matters. We actually saw recent consumer confidence data come in really strong. Confidence data is important because, again, as when we think about this whole sector of our economy that is built around the consumer and how much we spend, how confident the consumer is, whether it's the Michigan Sentiment Index or the overall Conference Board number, we're seeing numbers increase in some of the greatest numbers we've seen since 2011. So, for example, the University of Michigan runs a Consumer Sentiment Index. In June, that number jumped up to 78 from 72. That's a really impressive number. I know it doesn't sound like it, but on a scale of 1 to 100, consumers are becoming fairly confident in the future of our economy. Another type, the Consumer Confidence Board, rose to 98 from 86. That one's a scale of up to 130. So the 12-point gain in that one is the largest since 2011. So we're seeing big jumps in consumer and business optimism. That's a great sign because it means that we're beginning to see a reopening and it's working. Additionally, on top of that, when we think about what else is going on in the economy that's positive, well, it's a double-edged sword when it comes to inflation. Inflation right now is some of the lowest that we've seen in your lifetime, down around 1% inflation growth a year. It's very, very little. What that means is corporations can borrow money very low with interest rates so low. So they're able to refinance their debt for lower numbers, and that keeps them from going out of business and makes their finance costs lower. They have more money to spend or save and get to help them get through this. But at the same token, an inflationless economy is not the best thing for a long period of time. It can lead to deflation. If we're worth less tomorrow than we are today, that is a long-term systemic problem that we've never had in this country. That is for a while has existed in Japan and Europe. As of right now, we don't have that issue, and they have, and it can be very problematic. It's very hard to break that trend. So while inflation is only hovering around 1%, it's good to know that in the long run, we'd like to see that number tick higher as the economy gets going. Because if things cost you a little bit more, but you're earning a little bit more, and your value of your home is a little higher, all the old saying is, rising tides raise all boats. Inflation between 2 and 3% is not a terrible thing. That's the sweet spot. Hopefully we can get back there. So that's a bit of a negative number that we saw recently. Additionally, when we think about earnings, so far preliminary earnings for the second quarter are as bad as we expected. They're going to be down as much as 40%. The overall GDP for the second quarter could be down as much as 40%. And even with the jobs number coming out tomorrow, still having 14 million people on the unemployment line is really catastrophic and nowhere near where we were back in early February. So that's something to monitor. I did note that our manufacturing sector today, which makes up about 11% of our economy, actually is back in expansion mode. For the first time in the last 3 months, the month of June, our ability to manufacture is actually again expanding, not contracting. A lot of that's agriculture, but we are once again in growth mode there. So that's a real positive sign as what is to come as we continue to reopen. When it comes back to the Federal Reserve, they've done a lot to get us to this point. Now, the next big question is, What will the federal government do from this point forward? Will they do more? There's talk of another tax break program, maybe a payroll tax program. There's talk of another stimulus that you get money and you'd only be able to spend it within 50 miles of your house. You'd have to spend it on leisure, tourism, and so on. That one seems kind of odd to me. I'm not sure how they'd work that out. But probably the most simple is for the folks who are on unemployment benefits getting $600 a week, that's going to expire on July 31st. More than likely, that'll get extended but reduced to $300 a week so that the benefits they're receiving on unemployment aren't better than if they went back to work. Believe it or not, 83% of people who are unemployed today earn more money currently unemployed than they did in their old job. That's something we're probably going to have to focus on. But there is talk about extending the protection programs for small businesses. There is talk about a payroll tax holiday. There's also talk about finding other ways to stimulate the economy and the average consumer so that we continue to buy a bridge to the other side of this pandemic, simply because that's the one thing that'll get the U.S. economy going again. We don't want to fall off a fiscal cliff because we're running out of money. But at the same token, we can't print into oblivion either. So I think the next round is going to be, hotly debated, but there will be some more stimulus coming to help folks get through this, small businesses and consumers, in some variation from the government. And to be honest with you, we wouldn't be in this position we are today without the federal government doing what they've done so far. It has been effective, and it has brought us a bridge to the other side. It's why consumer spending is holding up and why businesses are being able to turn back on here, not easily, but are beginning that process somewhat effectively. And you're seeing that in the jobs number come back into the marketplace. So the economic data is beginning to show real green shoots, as we like to say. There is a variety of different areas, whether it's the housing market, the labor market, consumer spending market. Overall, there are beginnings of that. Heck, gasoline usage is up, depending on where you live, anywhere as much as 50 to 80% from the bottom. Year-over-year retail sales, in some cases, are down only as much as 10%. Like where I live, it's down 50% in New Jersey, but better than the 100% it was a month ago. So certainly an increase across the board in spending, and this idea of getting back to work is happening more so than ever. And not to mention, what we're finding is many companies continue to be able to succeed quite well in this environment. They've done better than expected. And so for that reason, the stock market has held up pretty well. Now, as in the past I've mentioned, I believe the stock market is expensive. Earnings are down significantly, yet the stock market is still down quite a bit from all-time highs. But reasons for concern of that, the fact that we're not earning a lot of money and we're only down about 3.5% on the S&P for the year, from the peak about 9% in a year. So it's still down quite a bit, but stocks are not cheap. They're not earning money, and they're back to near all-time high. And for that reason, I think you still want to be careful and make sure you own high quality companies that have the ability to pay a dividend or sustain themselves through this very volatile market environment. You don't want to overbet on stocks here, because let's assume for a minute that everything stays as is and we get control of the virus. But if we don't, it could be very problematic as states have to slow down their opening or shut down again. It could be problematic as just today Apple announced another 70 or so stores are going to have to shut down to let the virus cool off before they open up again. So there are aspects of this that could be very problematic, and for that reason, I think you want to be very careful with your stock exposure. Your bond exposure, interest rates seem to be pretty much stuck in a trading range here. So you want to own high quality bonds that are going to pay you an interest rate, maybe some municipal bonds from good states, government bonds as protection, or high quality corporate bonds. But probably not a lot of movement around interest rates right now, because the economy is kind of stuck in neutral, waiting for either an antiviral or a virus to get us out of this, or just us breaking the spread or the disease mutating away. But we're certainly not there yet from the most recent spikes. I'll wrap up the call with just a little bit on vaccines. We continue to update you on vaccines. We think it's important that you know that there is movement afoot going on out there. And probably the most exciting news of the day is an American company. And I think, as I mentioned in the past, it's important that we get an American company who can really help us as a country get out of this. But Pfizer announced in their partnership with BioNTech, they had jointly developed a vaccine called BNT162. What they found out is that they've tested 45 different people, and what they found is that in their low dose application, they're able to generate 1.8 to 2.8 neutralizing antibodies. That means they're generating more antibodies than people who have naturally recovered from the virus, to the tune of 1.8 to 2.8 times higher. What they found is that of the 24 patients they inoculated with two low doses, it positively affected all 24. So it's still new. It's a small study, and they have to have it peer-reviewed. But it's also not a phase 3 trial, which would be thousands of people. But certainly exciting news that an American company has a vaccine that they're actually going to go immediately into production because they believe they've got it, and they can produce millions of vials to be able to prepare it when and if they get FDA approval. The FDA has publicly said if a vaccine comes out that's 50% effective, they're willing to let it get into the marketplace as quickly as possible to be able to protect, again, first-line folks like hospital workers and older folks who might be susceptible to the virus. So that is a real solid announcement. One other one that's a little bit different, coming out of China, CanSino Biologics actually has a vaccine. They've created viruses, and the Chinese government has decided to begin to inoculate military personnel starting June 25th. So people in the Chinese military are receiving an inoculation right now for a vaccine that they believe works. That's pretty amazing that they are at that stage. They're at a phase 3 trials and willing to be able to try it system-wide on folks. We continue to hear good news out of the Oxford University study. They're now partnering with Brazil to create millions of vials for Brazil directly. Moderna, one of the earliest companies, is not only producing vaccine vials with AstraZeneca, they've partnered with a new firm called Catalent, where they think they can make up to 100 million doses of Moderna's vaccine in Bloomington, Indiana, by early fall, because they also believe they have it and are willing to start inoculating people in phase 3. Johnson & Johnson is also in a partnership with the European Union with their vaccine to be able to have it for delivery early in the new year. So there are some good news on that front. But here's probably the exciting part about this. During the month of July, we are going to have numerous, more than 10, as many as 15 different studies come out of different therapeutics. There are 133 now different therapeutics and vaccines that are in trial. So we're going to get lots of antivirus, lots of vaccine, lots of therapeutic information here in very short order. That's exciting because as we're going through a spike, if there's something we can have available to us, and as I mentioned in the past, I'm much more excited about an antibody or a therapeutic, because if there's something that can keep the pressure off of hospitals, you get sick, you take a therapeutic, and you're better a few days later, that would buy us the time needed to, one, get to a long-term vaccine, but two, more importantly, or as importantly, open up the U.S. economy without the threat of people getting significantly sick. So a good positive update. The stock market continues to hold on, albeit I think higher than it should be. I do think it's expensive. The economy has continued to open up, and we're seeing gain there. We're realizing that we still need to be very smart about the virus. We still need to be socially distant when we are around people we don't know. We need to wear masks in public, especially when we're in a place for longer than 15 minutes, especially indoors. Hopefully we can break the curve that's happening in these states that are accelerating by the knowledge that we have and the restrictions that have been put in place. We're seeing green shoots in the economy in the form of retail spending, businesses opening up, people going to restaurants, people participating in the economy, whether it's online or just by driving around and going visiting or taking a different new approach to spending, not like we were, but certainly an improvement. But ultimately, hopefully being smart about that process as we go down this path, because we don't want to let the virus become not only a personal issue with a societal issue with so many people dying globally and domestically, but if we continue on this path, the economic impact could also become very profound as well. Hopefully we can mitigate both here in the coming weeks, but it certainly bears to watch as these antivirals come to marketplace and vaccines, as we open up and as we make sure that the spike doesn't become so significant. Dr. Fauci just yesterday said we could have up to 100,000 people getting affected a day. That would be obviously very problematic because then the number simply spreads from there. Hopefully that's not the case and we're able to bend this before it gets significantly worse. As always, we try and give you these updates to really give you an idea of what's going on with the vaccine, the economy, the stock market, and the overall health of the U.S. economy and the folks related to the vaccine. I hope Independence Day is wonderful for you and your families. You get a chance to celebrate all things that we have to celebrate, the country, ourselves, and hopefully the successes to come. Stay safe. Wash your hands. Don't touch your nose. Wear a mask in public, and I look forward to talking to you all real soon. Thank you very much. Take care.